Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, this afternoon I'll be speaking about a sutta that occurs in the Sutta Nipata. This is called the Padana Sutta, the Discourse on Striving. I had already spoken about this sutta maybe more than a year ago, but for some reason the sutta was never recorded, and so it didn't get into the collection of recordings on the Sutta Nipata. So I'm speaking the sutta again, so this time it has to be recorded. And I found that I didn't have any notes on the sutta for giving the discourse last year. So the talk I give today maybe will be very different from the one that I gave last year, even though the text will be the same. Okay, and this sutta is a kind of dramatic representation of the Buddha's encounter with Mara during the period when he was striving for enlightenment. So this was before he actually attained Buddhahood, when he was still a bodhisattva seeking the supreme enlightenment. And so here the sutta begins in the handout at the bottom of page 51. And here the Buddha is relating the account of his experience of striving for enlightenment. So he says, while I was meditating for the attainment of, what's translated here as rest from exertion. Maybe a better translation would be release from bondage. For the attainment of release from bondage. With myself intent upon striving, near the river Nirandjara, having made a great effort, Namuchi approached me. Okay, I'll just stop at that point. Okay, who is Namuchi? Namuchi is a name, it's another name for Mara. The commentaries explain the name Namuchi as having the meaning, you see, there's a verb muchiti, which means to let go, to release. And then the prefix na means not. So the commentary explains the name Namuchi to mean the one who doesn't let go. In other words, the one who doesn't let beings escape from the grip of the world. And this is just another name for Mara. And in many suttas, we meet this figure Mara, who is something like the Buddhist equivalent of Satan in Christianity, the chief of the demons. And often Mara is spoken of as Papima, which means the evil one. But there is a significant difference between Mara in Buddhism and the devil in Christianity, so far as I understand it. In Christianity, the devil, at least in the popular picture, has some connection with hell. Is that correct? So the devil is seen as being the chief of hell, and his job in Christianity is to tempt people to commit deadly sins so that they'll be driven to hell. In Buddhism, Mara doesn't have any connection with hell at all. And has no interest in dragging beings down to the hell realms or to any kind of lower birth. Mara's function in Buddhism is simply to keep beings in bondage to samsara, to the round of birth and death, and especially to keep beings in bondage to the sensual realm of existence. That is, in the Buddha scheme of the three realms of existence, the sensual realm, the subtle meditative realm, and then the formless meditative realm, Mara is something like the doorkeeper at the top of the sensual realm, who wants to prevent beings from getting out of the sensual realm into the realm of subtle form or into the formless realm. But even he's not particularly concerned if beings do manage to escape from the sensual realm to the realm of subtle form or the formless realm. What he absolutely wants to prevent is beings from gaining liberation, liberation from the round of rebirths. And so Mara's main function is to keep beings tied up within samsara. And Mara takes on different appearances in the sutta. Sometimes he might appear as a frightful demon, because one of the keys to keeping people bound up in samsara is to frighten them. When people become afraid, then they lose their sense of judgment and they'll do anything to protect themselves from some kind of damage or loss. We can see this in ordinary human life as well. When people feel threatened or anxious, then they are ready to cheat, deceive others, or try to escape from their anxiety and fear by indulging themselves in pleasure. Sometimes Mara appears as, there's a word, I don't know if it's used very much, gallant. He's very suave, handsome, seductive, seemingly pleasant. And in this role, his mode of operation is to sweetly persuade the ascetics, the meditators, to give up their practice and return to an ordinary worldly way of life. Sometimes he might even be described as like a dandy with Brooks Brothers suit, sort of fancy manicured, fancy haircut, manicured nails, very suave, easy speaking, very convincing. Okay, now a question that comes up, very often comes up, when the Buddhist texts introduce this figure, Mara, does this signify a real being, or is Mara just a symbol? And I think there's no simple answer to this question, because I think the figure of Mara can be interpreted in either way, in both ways. And the commentaries, when they examine the suttas to see how the word Mara is used, how the figure of Mara functions within the text, have come up with a classification of what is called the five types of Mara, the five Maras. Okay, what are the five Maras? Okay, one of them is Mara as the defilements, Mara as the fun now, or kilesas. So in this sense, the word Mara is symbolic, or the figure of Mara is symbolic for the defilements of the mind, especially craving and heedlessness or negligence. Then Mara is also taken to be, in another sense, the second kind of Mara is called the Mara as the five aggregates. So the five aggregates, these are the five constituents of a living being, of a human person. We speak about material form or body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations or volitional activities, and consciousness, knowing, that which knows. And these are the five objects or bases for clinging. Clinging is the grasping of phenomena, especially grasping things as being I and mine. And what we take to be I and mine are the five aggregates. And because we take the five aggregates to be I and mine, then our minds become full of craving and greed and anger and hatred. And so the mind moves around between greed and hatred because of the clinging to the five aggregates. And this the five aggregates as the basis of clinging are called Mara. And so Mara, in this sense, is a symbol for the five aggregates insofar as they are the objects or bases for clinging. The third sense of Mara is called Abhisankara Mara, or we can call this more simply Karma Mara. Mara as karma. That is, because of the defilements, because of our greed and hatred and ignorance, we engage in various activities, actions, motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance. And these actions build up karma. And that karma is what drives us on within samsara. We could say that the karma is the result of the defilements. It's the consequence of the defilements. And so it's these karmic activities that lead us to one realm or another realm within this cycle of birth and death. And in this way, the karmic activities are a kind of, or we could say Mara is a kind of symbol for the karmic activities that drive us around within the cycle of birth and death. Okay, a fourth sense of Mara is death. In fact, the word Mara is related to the noun Marana, which means death. And so Mara is sometimes also called Machu Raja, which means the king of death. And so we could say that Mara is a symbol, in this sense, it's a symbol for human mortality, for the mortality of all living beings. That as long as we are living within this world, we are always subject to death. Okay, so we have now four senses of Mara, in which Mara is purely primarily symbolic. But there's a fifth sense of Mara spoken of in the text. And here Mara is called Mara Devaputta. The word Devaputta means a young deity, a young god. And in this sense, Mara is taken to be a real living being, not just a symbol, but he is a living being who's dwelling in the heavenly realm, not in hell. But it's said that he dwells in the highest heaven of the sense sphere. But it's said that he lives at the outskirts of this heaven, sort of an outer district, an outlying district, like a rebel in a kingdom who's dwelling at the outskirts of the kingdom. So Mara has in a sense with his assistants, they have fallen out of favor with the other gods in this heavenly world. But Mara seems to have like a special connection with human beings. So Mara can constantly appear to human beings and lead them astray. And he does this by tempting human beings to surrender to the forces of craving and sensual desire so that they will remain within the sensual realm. And the special target of Mara are those beings who take up, those people who take up the practice of meditation in order to reach enlightenment and liberation. And so Mara will appear to great meditators when they're practicing very diligently. Sometimes he'll appear in a vision to them. Sometimes he will just work through mental suggestion, trying to discourage meditators from their practice, trying to lead them astray. And we also can experience Mara if we make an earnest effort in meditation. It doesn't mean that you'll see Mara in the same way that the Buddha sees him before his enlightenment. But sometimes when you practice very diligently, what seems to be crazy desires will come into the mind. Sometimes a memory of something that happened a long time ago, and then you'll build up whole mental pictures, mental stories about an image that appears in the mind. And then you become filled with desire for something that's completely irrational or senseless. We could recognize this is the activity of Mara. Or sometimes one can become very discouraged. Even when one is practicing well and diligently, suddenly, there might come into the mind a desire just to stop and to give up. It's not the kind of natural discouragement that comes, but almost an irrational, sudden and irrational discouragement. And when that happens, you could recognize that this is the working of Mara. Sometimes Mara will use instruments in the natural world as a way of breaking one's effort. I used to find in the early days when I was practicing meditation, whenever I would sit in meditation, suddenly dogs would start barking. And I had built up a whole line in my mind, a whole problem with barking dogs. And if I would stop the meditation, the dog stops barking. And this was before I went to Sri Lanka, back in the 1960s, I think. It became such a problem that I decided I had to go to the find the house where the dogs were barking, ring the bell and speak to the owners of it, of the dog, and tell them, please, can you put a muzzle on your dog between the hours of 8 and 9 every evening so it wouldn't disturb me when I'm meditating? But when I would stop my meditation and go out into the street, the dog would stop barking, and I couldn't find the house where the dog was. Okay, when these things happen, we shouldn't overrate ourselves and think that the same Mara that's troubled the Buddha is troubling us. Because the way I see it, Mara is like a general. In fact, the texts speak of him as the general at the head of a whole army of assistants who are like privates and corporals, you know, just ordinary pawns, ordinary soldiers. And so when ordinary people like us, when we try to meditate, the chief Mara doesn't have to trouble himself to come and disturb us. But he has many little Maras who are always looking out over the human world for anybody who's making a serious effort to practice the Dhamma. And so these little Maras will come and trouble us. But it's when the great masters, bodhisattvas seeking enlightenment, those who are about to achieve arhatship, are practicing very diligently, then a kind of alarm goes off in the chamber of the chief Mara, and he realizes that none of his assistants can stop these great practitioners from reaching enlightenment. Then he comes down himself in order to do the work. In the Saṅyutta Nikāya, there's an interesting little chapter. It's called the Bhikkhuni Saṅyutta. It's a collection of just 10 suttas about bhikkhunis, Buddhist nuns, who are, all of them are arahants. But Mara apparently doesn't know this, and he comes to them in order to try to make them fall away from their meditation. And you might think that if it's nuns practicing, that Mara's task is to try to appear as the seducer, to entice them with sensual desire. But that is so only, I think, in the case of one or two of the nuns. But you could see from this little chapter how Mara uses different methods, different means of enticing people and pulling them away. In this collection, okay, the first nun, he doesn't try to seduce himself, but he tries to persuade her that she's wasting her time practicing meditation and she should go and enjoy sensual pleasures now while she's still young and beautiful. In the second case, Mara uses, could say, the line, the approach of the male chauvinist. He says to the nun, why are you practicing meditation? Women have very limited wisdom. They can't reach enlightenment. Only men can reach enlightenment. So you should take on a woman's task, cooking food, taking care of a house. But this nun answers the Buddha, answers Mara, and says that when one has concentration and wisdom, when one is seeing, examining phenomena with insight, it doesn't matter whether one is a woman or a man. In another case, Mara is speaking to Kisa Gotami. This was a woman who in her lay life had lost her son. Her little baby son had died, and then she became a nun. And so Mara says to her, you should go back into the world and try to beget more children. You've lost one son, but don't give up hope. You can still get more children. There's still time for you. But she says, I'm done with producing children. Okay, so Mara uses different approaches. And in these cases, whenever the nun hears Mara speaking to her, she pauses for a moment and she wonders, who is this speaking to me? Is this a human being? Or is this some kind of non-human being? And then she uses her meditative power to investigate and realizes that this is Mara who's come to me. And she says to him, I know you. You are Mara, the evil one. I'm not going to listen to you. And as soon as she says that, as soon as she's able to identify Mara, Mara loses. And he has no choice but to vanish from the scene and let the nun continue in peace. Okay, so now we'll come to the sutta dealing with the Buddha's encounter with Mara during the period when he's striving for enlightenment. Okay, so now in verse 426, we said that Mara or Namuchi approached me. And when he approached, Namuchi Karunung Vachung, Basamano Upagami. He came speaking compassionate words. Here the Pali uses the expression Karunung Vachung. That's words which have the flavor of karuna, compassion. But is Mara really compassionate for the bodhisattva? Not really. In reality, he wants to drive the bodhisattva away from his practice. But he's presenting himself not as the terrible, frightening demon. But before he came on the scene, he probably brushed his hair, maybe put on some face cream to make himself look very pleasant, practiced his most benign, kindly smile. And so he comes to the Buddha as if he's very much concerned about his well-being. And now we have to remember, the Buddha has not yet discovered the path to enlightenment. He's not yet discovered the middle way. But now he's been practicing in the way of extreme asceticism, the way of self-mortification. He had the belief, like many of the yogis and ascetics during this period, that the way to enlightenment lay in tormenting and torturing the body, driving it to the extreme of emaciation through long fasts, subjecting the body to pain and suffering, for example, by sleeping on thorns, by dwelling outside, exposing the body to the heat of the sun in the middle of the day, by going about naked during the cold season, bathing in cold rivers in the cold weather. And so this was how the bodhisattva was seeking enlightenment. And Mara comes to him and says, you have become very thin and your face has become discolored. And death is coming close to you. So this is somewhat, he's just almost like a very kind mother. You know, if you're not eating well, then you come, lose weight and you come to visit your mother. Your mother will say, ah, you're thin. You've lost your bright complexion. let me prepare some delicious food for you. And then she'll prepare many, many dishes and fill you till you become bloated with food. And so Mara is trying to convince the Buddha now that he's going to extremes. He's gotten too thin, discolored. And he says, in the next verse, 427, Sahasa Bhago Maranasa Ekangso Tava Jivitang. That as if the Buddha consists of like 1,000 parts or 1,000%, so he's 99.9% of him has gone the way of death. He's only 1% alive. He must have gotten so thin that the way he describes it in some other suttas, that there's only skin and bone left on his body. The flesh has just been withered away through long fasts. And Mara says, Jiva bo jivitang seyo, better to live. Jivang punyani kahasi, that if you live, you can do deeds of merit. Okay, with this word merit, we come to an important theme in this sutta and also in the life of the Buddha and in the whole Buddha spiritual perspective. In ancient Indian spirituality, there were two paths open to any person. One is the path of merit. The other is the path of liberation. The path of merit was considered the path to be followed by householders. That one marries and enters upon the state of a householder, and one performs deeds of merit. In the view of the Brahmins, one performs deeds of merit by sponsoring sacrifices and by making offerings to Brahmins and to ascetics. And so one does good deeds which will create meritorious karma, and through that meritorious karma, one can take rebirth in the heavens. And so Mara has no opposition, no resistance to anybody living a good, virtuous, meritorious way of life, aiming at rebirth in the heavenly world. But what Mara doesn't like is the people to take the other path. The other path is the path of liberation, because this path is based upon renunciation, the renunciation of sensual enjoyment, the elimination of craving and attachment, undertaking ascetic practices, practicing meditation, and cultivating wisdom or insight. Okay, and so now the Buddha, as a prince, he had been living the household life, a good meritorious life. And now Mara appears to be solicitous for the well-being of the Buddha, or Bodhisattva, and is telling him, go back to the palace. You've left behind a wife and child. You left your father and foster mother behind. You can go back, live a good life in the palace, gain merits, and be reborn in heaven. So he goes on in verse 428. He says, much merit will be heaped up by you by practicing the holy life. By this he doesn't mean the life of meditation, but living a good virtuous life in the world and practicing the sacrifice. These are the sacrifices that the kings would sponsor for the Brahmins to perform. But now Mara asks the key question. He says, what do you want with striving? What do you expect to get by making this very vigorous effort, punishing yourself, destroying your body? And now Mara, again, he's like a good uncle, benevolent mother. He's saying to the Buddha, or Bodhisattva, he's saying, this road of striving, this path of striving, is very difficult to travel. It's hard to practice, and it's hard to reach success by this practice. So give it up, go back to a comfortable life in the world, and do meritorious deeds. Okay, now, after Mara spoke these words, the Buddha addresses Mara, and the Buddha is going to call Mara's number. So the Buddha begins by addressing Mara. He calls him Pamatta Bandhu, which means kinsman of the negligent, kinsman of the heedless. And then he calls him Papima, evil one. So the Buddha knows that even though Mara seems to be very kind and to be speaking these words, these compassionate words, that he's not really concerned for the well-being of the Buddha. But rather, the Buddha says, yena tena idhagato. You've come here with your own purpose in mind. You have your own goal in coming here, not my well-being, but you want to keep me in blindness and in bondage and prevent me from finding the way to enlightenment for all the world. Then the Buddha says, I don't have even the slightest need of Mara. I don't have even the slightest need of merit. If you're going to speak to anyone, Mara, you should speak to those who have need of merits. The Buddha, through his many past lives, has acquired all of the merits that he needs to complete the way to Buddhahood. So there's no point for him to go back to the world and do more meritorious deeds. But now the Buddha is going to speak about the qualities that he has that are going to ensure his success. He says, Ati sada tata viryang panyacha mama vijati. I have faith. This is not faith in any kind of deity, but he has faith in his own capacities, his own strength, his own intelligence. And he has energy, strength, and vigor. And he has wisdom, the wisdom needed to reach enlightenment. So when the Bodhisattva here mentions these three qualities, faith, energy, and wisdom, what else goes along with those three qualities? Right, mindfulness and concentration. These are the five spiritual faculties. Here the verse doesn't mention them because the verse has to be constructed according to a certain meter. And anyway, the reader will know that when one mentions these three, that the other two are implied. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on and says, why do you ask me about life? Why do you try to urge me to live on, even though I am intent, devoted to achieving the goal. Okay, now the next verses that the Buddha speaks show his seriousness of purpose, but they also show that the Buddha has not yet discovered the true way to enlightenment, that he's still adhering to this view that self-mortification, self-torment is the way to enlightenment. He says, when I'm so intent, then my blood might dry up, my bile and phlegm might dry up, my flesh might waste away, but my mind becomes clearer, and all the more, here we have the mention mindfulness and concentration, all the more my mindfulness and wisdom and concentration become firm. So at this point, the Buddha is thinking that it's when the body shrivels up and becomes very thin and withered that the mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom become stronger. But later he will discover that through the self-mortification, the mindfulness and concentration don't become stronger, but actually they become weaker. And in order to be able to practice successfully, he has to give up this extreme way of practice, the self-mortification, and take up the middle way, the way that will involve taking a normal amount of food to bring strength and health to the body. And it's then when the body becomes strong and healthy that one can develop clear and calm mindfulness and concentration. Okay, he says, while I dwell thus, having reached the highest sensation, I think this means that he's become completely equanimous in mind. He has complete equanimity. My mind has no regard for sensual pleasures. See my purity. Okay, now the Buddha comes to, we might call this the main theme of the sutta, and that is the 10 armies of Mara. This starts in verse 438. And for those of you who know Chinese, I found that these verses also occur almost exactly as in the Pali in the Dajia Du Lun, the great treatise on the perfection of wisdom. They occur at page 169, line A11, continuing from there. And they also occur, the verses, some other places in the Chinese Tripitaka. Twice they're quoted in treatises, two treatises on calm and insight, Samatha and Vipassana. That's T number 46, number 1915, and 1916. If you do a search, taking the first two lines from the Dajia Du Lun, and then do a search, you'll get the other places where they occur. Okay, what are the 10 armies of Mara? Okay, the first of these armies is sensual pleasure. Well, actually, we should say the desire or craving for sensual pleasure, sensual desires. Because when, especially when one adopts the life of renunciation, and then one starts meditating vigorously, then the first trick that the mind plays is to pull one away through the allurement of sensual desire. And so different types of sensual attraction will start playing out in the mind's eye. When this happens, one can recognize that this is an army of Mara come to attack me. In the case of the Bodhisattva, we should remember that he was living in the palace where he was always surrounded by dancing girls, singing girls. And so when he renounced the life of the palace and went to meditate in seclusion, doubtlessly there would come images into his mind of his delights and amusements with the dancing girls, singing girls. And he would feel drawn back to the palace and had to struggle against sensual desire. Then when sensual desire is defeated temporarily, the next army of Mara that appears is called, the Pali expression is Arati, which is translated discontent, that is not quite accurate. Or it's not rich enough. It doesn't really capture the nuances of Arati. Arati is a kind of combination of deep dissatisfaction, boredom, tedium, which comes because the mind has been accustomed to sensual enjoyment. Whenever a desire comes into the mind in the worldly life, one's immediate impulse is to act upon that desire and indulge it. But now when sensual desires arise, one resists them. In that way, one has conquered the first army of Mara. But one has not yet reached any deep state of peace and happiness and joy. So what opens up is a kind of barren desert, like there's no pleasure, no joy in this life. Here one can be sitting in a little hut under a tree, and it seems like if one sets the alarm for 1 hour, after 15 minutes one is peeking at the clock. Is the hour close to an end yet? What? Only 15 minutes have gone by? Wow, I can't believe that time is going so slow. And then in these days, in the time of the Buddha, there were no books, no computers. And he was living pretty much alone, not in company with others to talk to. And so you have a whole day of this. Like, maybe he starts the first meditation in the morning, and he thinks, am I going to have to do this until 10, 11 o'clock at night? Nothing is happening. It's just so boring. And then it becomes very, very disappointing. It becomes very disappointed. One becomes discouraged and wants to give up and quit. But if one is determined, then one will resist that and continue on. And then one comes to the third army of Mara. Okay, this would come up especially when somebody like the Buddha has taken up the practice of extreme asceticism, fasting for long periods of time, just taking maybe one handful of food every day for 2 weeks or a month. And so then there will come up strong hunger and thirst. Not to speak of the Buddha's kind of practice, but like if you haven't taken the 8 precepts before, and you take the 8 precepts not to take any food after 12 noon, after midday, then 5:30, you've had a good lunch, sufficient lunch. 5:30, 6 o'clock comes around, your eye catches sight of a clock or a watch. 5:30, 6 o'clock, and I'm not going to have supper tonight. This is very dangerous. Maybe I'll get sick. Maybe I'll die tonight. Perhaps I won't make it through till the next day. Yeah, I'd better not continue with this extreme ascetic practice of giving up supper tonight. And then you have stabbing pains of hunger at 6 o'clock. But if somebody were to say, let's go to a movie tonight, give up the supper. There's an interesting show playing. No hunger at all. You could watch the play, watch the movie for 3 hours, not a thought of hunger or thirst. But now, to practice the day, meditation through the day, 5:30, 6 o'clock, I'm starving. Okay, so hunger and thirst come. Okay, if one resists the hunger and thirst, then there comes craving. I don't really know how this craving differs from the craving for sensual pleasures. Maybe this will be craving for other things besides sensual pleasures. Maybe one will start thinking about one has given up the prospects for a good job, one could have gotten wealthy. The Buddha might be thinking, I could have been continued as a prince and become a king, ruling over the kingdom, and so craving for power. Okay, one resists craving, and then the next army of Mara, this is called sloth and torpor, tina mida, dullness or drowsiness. And this is not the ordinary sleepiness, but this is a kind of morbid drowsiness that comes because the meditation has not picked up energy. And so even though one might have had a good sleep during the night, but the next day, maybe it happens middle of the afternoon, suddenly one becomes extremely drowsy, the mind becomes dull, somewhat like when the sky is gray, this kind of steel gray, not heavy rain, not snow, but it's just been gray day after day. The sky is hanging very heavy. The mind becomes just like that gray sky. Nothing is happening, the mind becomes heavy and dull, and then one starts drowsing off, dozing off. One loses one's energy and one starts dozing off. Okay, when one recovers from that dullness and drowsiness, then the sixth army is fear. This takes many forms. Sometimes it can be fear that one is not going to succeed in one's practice. Sometimes the mind can conjure up fearful images. Or it can be a fear that one is wasting one's life. Or a fear that one is following a wrong path. Okay, the seventh army is doubt. Okay, this is when one starts questioning. Is this really the way to enlightenment? Is there really such a thing as enlightenment? Is there any point in this practice? Any truth in this teaching? if one is not the future Buddha, but a follower of the Buddha, then one starts questioning, was the Buddha really an enlightened one, or just a good, wise sage and moralist? Is the Dhamma really the ultimate truth, or just some system of ideas that the Buddha thought up and taught? Is this practice of meditation really going to be fruitful, or just a way of deluding myself, hypnotizing myself, and convincing myself that I'm becoming a spiritual person? Okay, the eighth army, it's one I'm a little uncertain about exactly the meaning of it. The Pali says Makkhatamba. The Chinese have translated it as Chun Wei, anger, hatred and anger, which to my mind doesn't seem to be very accurate as a translation of Makkhatamba. The commentary glosses Makkhatamba as mana, which means conceit. But K.R. Norman has translated hypocrisy and obstinacy, which I'm not sure if that's correct. But obstinacy, one could see that sometimes when somebody is practicing, if they start to have some success, then they become dogmatic and convinced, my way is the right way. And then they resist suggestions from others, they become rigid in their mind. Okay, then the next two, the ninth and tenth armies of Mara, are the armies that come after one starts to achieve some success. Maybe one starts gaining good states of concentration, one has not yet become enlightened. And so one gains a reputation as being an accomplished meditator, a very sincere, earnest ascetic. And so then people, and this would be especially the case in India during the Buddha's time, when people had a lot of respect and reverence for the renunciants, people will get respect for you, then they show honor to you, veneration, they make offerings to you, and one becomes famous and well known, one gets a good reputation. And then if one is not careful, if one is not heedful, then one will be swept away by this gain, honor and renown, and think, ah, I must be really somebody special, a truly accomplished practitioner. And then one starts praising oneself and disparaging others. I am a great meditator. Those others are just hypocrites and pretenders. Okay, so these are the 10 armies of Mara. And though Mara is speaking them to the Buddha, but we should take note of these 10 armies since we meet them in our own practice. Okay, I'll try to go through more quickly now. Okay, now the Buddha says in the next verses, he says, these are your armies, O Mara. This is the force of Kanha. Kanha means the dark one. One who is not a hero cannot conquer them. But if one conquers them, then one obtains happiness. Then the next verse, I don't agree with the translation here. Here the translation puts this as a question, should I wear munja grass? But the text that should be taken as a statement, Asa munjang parihare, I am wearing munja grass. Then he says, Diratu mamma jivitang, woe upon life here. Okay, what is munja grass? According to the commentary, in India, when soldiers would go into battle, a kind of sign of their determination to fight to the death against their enemies, they would take the special kind of grass. It's considered a good omen to use this grass. And they would put it on their helmet, on their shield, on their armor, on their chest. And then they would go into battle wearing this munja grass. And by wearing the munja grass, it means that I am determined to fight to the death. Either I conquer in this battle, or I will be killed by my enemy. And so the Buddha is saying, he's not asking a question, should I wear munja grass? But he's saying, I am wearing munja grass, since I'm ready to fight to the death. Death in battle is better for me than that I should live on as somebody who's been conquered. He's not going to return to the palace and live as a prince, but he'll either die or come out as the all-enlightened one. Then he speaks about Mara as being surrounded by his army, verse 442. And Mara is sitting on his elephant. This is the picture that we get when the Buddha is sitting under the Bodhi tree. Mara comes to attack him, sitting on an elephant with all of his demons trying to push the Bodhisattva away from his place beneath the Bodhi tree. Then the Buddha says that army of yours, which the world cannot overcome, I shall break it and destroy it. Destroy it how? With wisdom. Having brought my thoughts under control and making my mindfulness well established, I shall wander from kingdom to kingdom, training many disciples. That's another thing that Mara doesn't want. After the Buddha reaches enlightenment, there's another sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya where Mara says to the Buddha, even though you have gained enlightenment and you have escaped me, don't go around trying to teach others. They won't be able to understand. You'll be wasting your time. Just keep your enlightenment to yourself. Live peacefully and pass away peacefully. But don't wear yourself out trying to teach. But here the Bodhisattva says, I shall go from realm to realm teaching others. And then the Buddha says in verse 445 that my disciples, dwelling diligently, resolute, practicing my teaching, they will escape from you and they will reach the sorrowless state, that is the state of nirvana. Okay, now the next verse, it seems to me it's been put into the sutta out of its proper place. Because here, Mara is speaking as if he's referring to the Buddha not as the Bodhisattva seeking enlightenment, but he's speaking about him as one who's already enlightened. He says, for 7 years I have followed the Blessed One, step by step. I have not obtained an opportunity against the fully enlightened one. the verse says, Sambuddhassa sati mato. I have not obtained an opportunity against the fully enlightened one who possesses mindfulness. So this verse must come from a different period, not from the time when Mara is battling with the Bodhisattva under the Bodhi tree, but, and he says 7 years, so this must be 1 year after the Buddha's enlightenment. So after the Buddha achieved enlightenment, Mara still didn't give up. He thought, maybe it's possible to make an enlightened one fall away from his enlightenment. So in the first year of the Buddha's teaching career, Mara continued to follow the Buddha, trying to tempt him with his beautiful daughters, who are called Tanha, Raga, and Arati, craving, lust, and discontent. Sometimes Mara would try to frighten the Buddha without success. So in various ways, Mara tried to knock the Buddha down from his enlightenment. And he did this for a whole year, but after 1 year, he realized that the Buddha can never fall away from his enlightenment. So now he's speaking 1 year after the Buddha's enlightenment and says that for these 7 years, the 6 years when the Buddha as a Bodhisattva was struggling for enlightenment and the first year after the enlightenment, I have been trying to get an opening, to get a grip on the Buddha's mind, but all of my tactics have proved futile. And then he gives a simile. It's like a bird. Actually, this is a crow, which sees down below. It's flying in the sky, and it sees an object down below, and it thinks this is a lump of fat with maybe some meat in it. And he thinks it's a nice, delicious meal for me. Then the crow descends from the sky and jumps upon this apparent lump of fat. And it turns out to be very hard, a very hard lump of fat. And it pecks at the lump of fat. And every time it pecks at it with its beak, it hurts its beak, but it can't bite that lump of fat. Why can't it bite into the lump of fat? Because the lump of fat isn't a lump of fat, but it's a stone. And so finally, after the crow attacks that stone from one angle, another angle, another angle, and all the time, each time, it only injures itself, it gets hurt, then it realizes this is not fat. This is a stone. And it gives up and flies away. And so Mara says, now I'm giving up in my attempts to attack the Buddha and I'll go away. And then Mara is depicted as carrying around an instrument of veena that's like the Indian lute. And when he carries the lute around, he plays the lute and he sings sweet songs to try to persuade the Buddha to live a life of sensual pleasures. He'll sing songs of love and songs that will remind him of the pleasures he enjoyed in the palace. But now he's become very sad and dejected. And so his lute falls away from his arm, and then he disappears on the spot. Okay, so this is the sutta on striving. Okay, thank you for your attention, and we'll end by sharing the merits. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang rakantu sa sanang akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu de sanang akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu mang parang etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu.